My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. This is another little special episode for you. This is a chat with Kevin Odegaard, who plays a very small but fascinating, role in Bob's life, in Bob's career. I didn't know going into this what it would be like, because sometimes you interview people in this situation and they don't really want to talk about the thing that you are there to talk to them about, but they kind of feel obliged to. It wasn't like that at all with Kevin. He was so generous with his time. He told great stories. I mean, there's a great Bob Dylan impression coming up. Everyone's got one, haven't they? He was a real joy to speak to. It's one of my favourite interviews I think I've ever done, because he gave us the goods, which, as I say, was an absolute joy to hear. Before we get to that, a couple of bits of admin. First up, the Patreon show is finished. I'm just saying this again. I know I mentioned it in my last episode, but I'm still getting messages from people asking where it is and why the link won't work. I had to finish the Patreon show, the bonus show, because I haven't got the time to do it. So apologies about that. But like I said before, thank you if you did subscribe, and apologies if you missed the boat. One of the things I've been making instead of that is a new season of Blood on the Tracks. This is the podcast I've been making with Double Elvis, who make the Disgraceland podcast and Badlands, amongst others. We did a season on Bob that was so much fun. And by the way, thanks for your messages on that. I had quite a few messages on that, especially the last episode. If you don't check out any of the episodes apart from one, then make sure it's the last episode. I'm really proud of that. I think the team did a brilliant job on that. The latest season, though, is all about Brian Wilson, another kind of major figure in the world of popular music in our lifetimes. And this season is all about him going in to make the Smile album, which, as I'm sure you know, was supposed to be kind of his masterpiece, I guess, an album that was even bigger than Pet Sounds. And it ended up costing him almost his life, almost his sanity. I think that album is fascinating. I love that album as well, because, spoiler, not to spoil too much for you, but he goes into to make the album in the 60s, doesn't, and has a complete breakdown. But then in the early noughties, makes the album again and releases it. And I think the released album, his Brian Wilson Presents Smile, it's a brilliant, brilliant listen. So this season of Blood on the Tracks is all about Brian Wilson, from making the Smile album right through to now. It's an amazing story, and I'm so thankful that I'm able to tell it to you over 10 episodes. I'll put a link in this episode's description if you fancy checking that out. Let's get on with today's episode on this podcast, shall we? So as I say, this is a chat with Kevin Odegaard, who, as I'm sure you know, played on the Blood on the Tracks album. He was one of the musicians that was part of that re-record when Bob re-records some songs on the album, adding a full band to them. And Kevin's stories are amazing. I had so much fun chatting to him. I think I left in the edit the fact that we're talking to him via his boat, which was nice. And chatting to him afterwards, he sounded like he was living the dream, really, just cruising around on his boat, having a lovely old time, telling amazing stories like the ones he tells us in this podcast. So let's have a listen, shall we? This is me chatting to Kevin Odegaard about Blood on the Tracks, amongst other things. Let me start by saying what a treat this is, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining me. I've done a lot of Zoom interviews over the past couple of years. I don't think I've ever spoke to anyone that's on a boat. That's where you are right now, isn't it?
I'm on a boat. at home.
And whereabouts are you?
In the middle of the state of Florida. Just picked up an old boat. And we're going across the state in the Okeechobee Canal.
Ah, nice. So this is what? Is this your home permanently at the moment?
It is. We are no longer snowbirds. We live here all the time.
Wow. And how's boat life been treating you?
Boat life is good. We haven't been to the Bahamas as much as we like. That's what we have in mind for the golden years in our dotage. Spend a lot of time out around the Exumas, the last pristine waters on the planet.
Really nice. And you sent me some photos of the boat, and it looks incredible. I'm not sure, entirely sure, if that's the one you're in right now, but there was a boat that you had, the Tangled Up in Blue. Is that what you've called it?
That's it.
It looks gorgeous. It looks really nice. I mean, there's so much to talk to you about. I mean, you've had this great career. You've worked for the National Academy of Songwriters, which we'll get onto. You've been on tour and you've made albums. You've co-authored a book as well, of course, that was great. And as I'm sure you know, you've played on one of the most iconic albums of all time. It's been quite the journey. Let's start with that iconic album. So when you get called to make Blood on the Tracks, and I'll get you to tell the story in a second, but just give us an idea of how old you are and what are you doing at that particular moment?
Well, I was 24. It was the year 1974. And I was a railroad brakeman. And I was dodging phone calls at home in my apartment above the rail yards, watching a program popular at that time called Kojak.
Oh, yeah.
Who loved Baby? And Kelly Sabalas. We never missed it. So I was ignoring the phone as it rang. Didn't want to go out in the cold. It was a very cold December of 1974. But after the program ended, I relented, picked up the phone, and it was David Zimmerman, who was a friend and my personal manager at that point in time. David was not alone. David was doing the talking, but you could tell someone else was in the room, kind of prompting him. So his desire was to find a guitar, a particular guitar, often referred to as the Joan Baez Martin 0042. He was looking for a gut string. I had a friend down in Dinkytown named Chris Weber, so I hung up with David and I called Chris Weber, and Chris said, were you in my store this week? Because I have that very guitar on the wall right behind me on consignment. And I said, no, I wasn't in your store. I'm just looking for it. And he said, well, who wants it? I said, well, David Zimmerman. And he was savvy. He knew who David was and who David's big brother was. And he said, well, what does he want it for? I said, well, session for his brother. And it took me a while to get permission to tell him that, because David was on the down low. He wanted to keep everything very quiet, not get the town in a tizzy. It's just musicians can go crazy when they hear Dylan's in the studio. So we gathered a band between David and I. We cherry picked the town for a rhythm section. Chris wangled his way into the sessions by insisting that he accompany his consignment guitar. And so he came with me to the studio the very next night at 5 p.m. when he arrived at Sound 80 to find the rhythm section, Billy Peterson and Bill Berg, and my choice for keyboard player, Greg Inhofer.
Just to stop you there, I mean, so you actually had a hand in properly putting the band together. That's even more of a hand than I thought, and that was a pretty big hand to begin with.
My choices didn't always work out. I chose my good friend Stan Kipper to play drums, and Doug Nelson, who was a great fretless bass player. And both would have been good, but David was already hitting a home run with this rhythm section jazz players. Berg and Peterson had just recently finished Dreams and all that stuff, Leo Kottke's masterpiece, Leo's own very own Blood on the Tracks, if you will. Now, Leo never plays anything the same way twice. And so these guys are great on the pickup, and they like to stay loose, and they'll do it differently, just as differently as Leo does every time around. So it was the perfect setup, and it was the perfect practice for going into the studio with Bob, who was a little pensive at first, but loosened up. He was delighted to know that Bill Berg graduated behind him by a few years from Hibbing High School, and that they knew a lot of the same people. That relaxed Bob, and so we became like a garage band. The air was not thick with celebrity or anything like that anymore. It was just a bunch of guys hanging around in Minnesota, and which is, I think, exactly what they were looking for.
Just going back to a couple of things. I mean, so at this time, you're a musician, but not a full-time professional musician. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. I've never been a full-time musician. I've been an advocate. I've worked in Hollywood on behalf of songwriters, rights and earnings. But at that point, I was the brakeman on the railroad, and I had a job to get back to. And we all were. Berg and Peterson. Berg had his car packed. He was ready to move to Los Angeles and try and make it as a studio musician. He wound up instead being Walt Disney's lead animator, Beauty and the Beast, and 27 other films after that. That's how things happen.
That's an incredible story that you know, you a musician but not a professional musician just suddenly ends up working with one of the biggest stars in the world at that time, one of the biggest stars of all time. How did you know Bob's brother then?
I made a point to introduce myself when I read about an album he had done earlier on Columbia Records. And so I imposed myself on him, and he and my mother became friends. And later on, we wound up at many of the same events, including events that Bob was present at, because my girlfriend at the time was family. She was a cousin of the Zimmerman-Ruttman clan. And so we were social friends by the time Blood on the Tracks rolled around, everybody was familiar with everyone else.
The story of how the album came to you guys is kind of famous now, that Dylan's brother told him the songs were a little sparse, a little maybe too depressing, and obviously they decided to rework them with you and the rest of the band. Were you told that when the session started? Were you told that we tried recording it in New York and some of the tracks we don't really like? Or were you just told this is a Bob Dylan session and not to ask any questions?
We're going to try one song. That's what we were told. We're going to try one song. That song turned out to be Idiot Wind. I did not play on Idiot Wind. He taught the song to Chris in the vocal booth at Sound 80. Which, by the way, at one time was regarded by the Guinness Book of World Records as the quietest room on planet Earth. It would drive you crazy if you stayed in that room alone for 8 minutes or longer. that was the lore.
So is that how the sessions worked, that Bob taught them to Chris and then he led the band?
That's exactly the way everything went. I didn't play that first night, and Billy had to go to his club gig. Billy Peterson was a great club bass player, and he was playing at the Longhorn downtown. And his band leader, Bobby Rockwell, said, "I don't care who you're playing with, you're going to be on time. You're going to be on the stage at Downbeat. This is your job. Get your feet on the ground and get down here." So he had to leave. So there's no bass on the second song, which is, I believe, If You See Her, Say Hello.
And that's the reason for it. So there's no bass on that song because he had to go back to his day job. That's amazing.
Yeah. Our jobs were key to all of us. Greg Inhofer was a club musician and still is. I never had the courage to do that, nor was I ever as good, and I'm not saying this to compliment myself, but I never reached the point that I got to on the following Monday for 6 minutes, the 6 minutes of Tangled Up in Blue. I never played that well, and I never have since. I've tried, but the elements in the room, working with Bob, my familiarity with old friends, everything just added up to a moment in my life that I could never repeat. and would never repeat. And I just was playing at the top of my skills. And years and years later, 30 years later or so, I realized that I'd done an all right job.
I think it's more than an all right job. I think it's a stunning job. That's kind of fascinating that you said that was a really great performance that you're not sure you could do again. And the whole guitar thing, the right guitar in the right place, it's almost like fate was drawing you to this particular record. Does it feel that way to you, or is that just a load of coincidences?
It was happenstance. It was serendipitous. We none of us planned on being there. Later, in retrospect, we could look back and read about the New York sessions. They were evidently not very fun. And there was one musician out of New York who actually quit, walked off, had his name taken off the project. But in Minneapolis, it was casual, mostly because of the chemistry between Bill Berg and Bobby Zimmerman. It was terrific. It was just a bunch of guys in a garage hanging out, and Bobby was the songwriter. It was a lot of fun for him. And that first song went into, I don't know, 7 or 8 takes. But the second song was done in just a matter of about 2 or 3. All of the outtakes have gone away someplace. I think Bob probably erased them. But the only remaining or existing tracks are the final 5 songs that we did in Minneapolis. 2 of them on that first night. And then Bob was happy enough that the next day the phone rang for all of us. And David said, by the way, bring your guitar, because you're going to play Monday night. We're going to put you on a song. So I learned later that was Greg Inhofer repaying the favor of me getting him the gig. He put a word in for me, and I was able to bring my guitar. I had a Martin D28, 1969 Rosewood that I'd gotten from Manny's Music in New York City, where Bob had shopped for a lot of his stuff. So that was night one. On night two, we did, Chris learned Tangled Up in Blue. He learned it in G, the key of G. And he came out and taught it to the band. And we ran it down with Bob, and it was just fine. And then Bob turned on his heel and looked me right between the eyes and said, well, what did you think? What do you think? And I forgot who I was with, and I forgot my place in the room in life. And I said, well, it's passable. It's okay. It's passable. And Bob said, passable? And so I was sweating through my clothes by this time. It happens fast. And I suggested we move it up into the key of A to give it more bite, more urgency. And so Bob would kind of reach for the notes a little bit more than he was. A is a great, like, rockabilly key, and it really spits out at you. Every key has a personality. This much I know. I'm not Segovia, but I know that each key comes from a different place in the world, and they all have very well-defined personalities. And that A bites like and it cuts like a knife. It just goes through everything. I have perfect pitch, but only in the key of A. I can hum you an A.
Very specific, perfect pitch. So I'm no music expert, but I'm pretty sure that Tangled Up in Blue remained in the key of A. So you altered history there.
It did. We've tried a few bars, and it really locked in right away. And before we even finished one verse, Bob was motioning, and of course, Paul Martinson, Shorty as he was known, had already had the tape running. He rolled a quarter inch safety mix It was called a safety mix. He constantly had that thing going, but he put on the 2-inch master, and we recorded Tangled Up in Blue on an 8-track. It was 8 tracks at that point. And might have been 16. No, it was 2-inch. It would have been 16. 3M tape manufactured right there in Minnesota. 226, I believe, was the type of tape. And we ran it down and recorded it. And then the air became very, very still. And we all looked at our shoes and took a breath and looked back up. And personally, I gulped, because I'd never witnessed or seen anybody do anything like that in my life. Bob reeled off the verses in real time, live vocal, no headphones. It was an amazing performance, and I was 5 feet from him. He was looking at everybody. He was referencing everybody. He stood on the corner of the control room and made eye contact with everybody. And when you're making eye contact with Bob Dylan, you're doing his bidding. You're doing what he wants you to do. Cause he can communicate where he wants to go and the way he moves. He was really very, very far into the storytelling aspect of that song. And it was like being in the best movie you've ever seen in your entire life. It was like being an actor in your favorite movie. I couldn't believe it for weeks afterward. I couldn't believe it had really happened.
Wow, that sounds incredible. And you know, to have him do that live in front of you, I'm sure was great. Did you feel any pressure? Because I mean, he was, as I say, such a big star at this point, and you guys, I'm guessing, hadn't been in a studio in this way before with such a big star. It doesn't sound like on the record that anyone's kind of nervously playing or anything like that.
No, we forgot to get nervous. We were comfortable enough. It was a clubhouse atmosphere. There were no drugs or anything to loosen us up. It was just a comfortable clubhouse sort of thing. His son Jacob was there. I ran across the street to the liquor store and got him a carton of, I believe it was chocolate milk. So, and when I ran into Jacob years later, he didn't remember it, of course, but that was my role. After I don't think I could have played after that. I don't think I could have picked up again. I think I was more nervous after I was done than I was beforehand. The rest of the guys were pros. The rest of the guys do this in their sleep, not me. I had never been to a session anything like this. I mean, Berg and Peterson and those guys, the Righteous Brothers, Sonny and Cher, all these people would come through town, Chuck Berry, they're the pickup band. They're the guys who are not cowed by celebrity. These are professionals. I have a great deal of admiration for all of these people. I could never do what these guys did night after night, and I didn't. I kept day jobs. I played it safe.
I just love the fact that that you went and got Jacob some chocolate milk. I mean, who says rock and roll is dead? That's what's happening when the sessions are on. You're going to get chocolate milk. As far as actually your performance on the album, were you given license to kind of do what you want, or were you given very specific details on you play this and you stop playing then, and this is how I want you to play it?
Bob interacted with Bill Berg only. And said, can you play this with brushes? Can you play this with sticks? And I believe Tangled is, yeah, it's brush sticks. This guy from Minnesota invented brush sticks. And so that's what you hear. But what Berg's magnificent gift is he plays at the very end of the beat. A beat is, let's say a beat is a block long. Well, he's on the curb at the end of the block hitting that beat, and it has the effect of kind of sucking you in.
Mm.
And he did that on Idiot Win. He did that on Tangled. Both. Those are the only instructions other than Bob jumping on an instrument. He overdubbed piano. He overdubbed mandolin. Later on, Peter Ostrusko came in and played mandolin. Bob put another mandolin part on top. He overdubbed guitar, a flamenco guitar.
You really were given kind of no real specifics, just talk to get on with it. I just asked rather to get on with it, I guess. Which is kind of great for you, I guess, because again, there's no real pressure there. You're just playing the song. As far as specifics, Tangled Up in Blue, that's you on the opening riff, right? That kind of famous opener.
I nicked it from a very slow version of that figure on an album called Joy of Cooking. Tony and Terry out of the Bay Area. It's called Midnight Blues. And if you listen to Midnight Blues and then speed it up, that's the lick that you hear in the beginning of Tangled Up.
Oh, wow. I'll check that out.
And I did that and it fit the song. And I walked into the control booth after it was over. I said, Bob, you're going to like what I did. You should turn it up in the mix. That was the bridge too far. So he just kind of nodded at me and said, yeah, okay, kid, whatever. Actually, Leo Kottke was there that day. That was important. Wow. They were chatting, and Leo didn't realize who Bob was for the next 25 years. Then he began telling the story in his concerts, and it was a hilarious anecdote. He said, it was Bob Dylan. Yeah. He was having a conversation. He had no idea.
Tangled Up in Blue, I mean, it's such an enduring song, and that riff is so enduring as well. When you listen back to that now, what are your feelings? I mean, I'm guessing you're enormously proud of it.
There's a particular escalator in the Atlanta airport that it seems every time we go through there, it plays it. Other than that, I don't really put it on or listen to it. It plays enough on intercom systems and supermarkets and out in public that I don't really ever need to put it on. I did listen to the new remix because they did such a great job on everything. More Blood, More Tracks is a work of art in itself, watching the songs progress.
Yeah. Which,
and it's a reissue and a remix of the Minneapolis tracks. They did save the 2-inch tape on that one. So the guys were able to do, Steve Berkowitz was part of that mix, and Steve Adabo. And they did a fantastic job remixing. They took the echo out of the New York sessions and they made our version cleaner. I'm happy that you can clearly hear my guitar on that one. So my kids will finally believe me. And
was it just Tangled Up in Blue that you played on? I mean, you're credited in some areas on all the songs.
Yeah, I was out of service after Tangled Up in Blue. I was emotionally wrought. I was done. I was finished. Kaput. It was over. I couldn't have another song. I would have shaken and blown it. I would have done a bad job. I don't want to do a bad job. I didn't get what was going on until after it was over. But they had a great time after that. They did If You See Her, Say Hello, or was it, Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts was a lot of fun, because that was like also very cinematic. And one take, and David came out and said, when you think the song is over, it's not. And the very last song, Peter Ostrusko was brought in to play mandolin on. Bob overdubbed another mandolin on top of that. Ostrusko went home, went to bed, sick, got up the next morning and told his friend Tom, Tom, you'll never believe what happened to me in my dream last night. I dreamed I played on a Bob Dylan session. And Tom said, that was no dream, Peter. You were there. So we all have different stunned reactions. The pros in the room, Greg, Billy, Bill, we all went back to our lives. We all went, you know, it's pretty much like the last verse of Tangled Up in Blue. Some are mathematicians. Some are carpenters. Don't know how it all got started. Don't know what they did with lives. You know, we had lives to go back to and this to tell our grandchildren about, which I intend to do when they come of age. So everything worked out for the better. And I stayed with my day jobs, played it safe.
Yeah, but what an incredible moment and thing to be involved with. I mean, and especially I know that you said you only played on Tangled Up in Blue, but if you're going to pick a song, probably pick that one. Probably pick the opener and the one that is still, as you say, played almost everywhere today, decades later. As you were cutting it, did you know that this was going to be a huge album? Because at this point in Bob's career, He's doing well. He has made a sort of mini comeback with Planet Waves, but he's not the star of the mid 60s. And this song, this album rather, would obviously go on to become one of his biggest, if not his biggest. Was there a feeling that this was going to be a huge classic record, or for you guys, was it just a Bob Dylan album and you didn't really know what its future held?
To me, New Morning was his comeback. I played New Morning nonstop. And as a fan, I was crazy for that album. Not everybody loved it. And I just got it in a new quadraphonic mix.
Oh, it's great. That's a great record.
Because I loved it so much, and I still do. I thought that was the be-all, end-all comeback, but it wasn't. When Tangled Up in Blue ended and we hit that silent spot, looked at our shoes, and we looked around at each other, and I think Billy Peterson said, wow, that said it all. And we knew, yes, at that moment, I knew, they knew, Bob knew that it was huge. And he came up to them in the parking lot afterward at Sound 80 and said, do you know what we did in there? You realize what we accomplished? Did you realize how good that was? And he really appreciated getting to work with those two guys. And the results that came out of it. But he was a virtuoso himself at that point in his career. All of his overdubs, all of his playing, all of his vocals, it's a very, very raw, live take album, the whole thing. As you know, as evidenced in More Blood, More Tracks, the New York stuff was as well, but they just didn't have as much fun or get there as quickly as Minneapolis sessions did.
No, and I think you can definitely pick up on that on More Blood, More Tracks. Dylan himself, I mean, so much has been made about the album and people have called it his divorce album, and he has said that's not true. But obviously it's quite an intense record and personal sounding from a listener's point of view. I mean, you've said that you had fun in the studio. What was it like for Dylan performing these songs in front of you? Did it look intense? Was he emotional, or was this just him in the studio performing these things and that was part of his job?
Good question. He'd been living with the material for so long that he was living the songs. He was visibly emotional. Like I've never seen him in concert. I've seen him a few times in concert. And he's a showman, and he gets up there and he does his thing, and it's wonderful. But I've never seen him perform or behave in the way that he did during the sessions for Blood on the Tracks in Minneapolis. He was emotionally 100% invested in the material. He knew by the mistakes that he'd made before, he knew by the feel of what he'd gotten in New York and elsewhere, that, no, I don't want it like that. I want it to go like this. And when he communicated with Berg, and less so to me and the others, what he wanted, we did our best to deliver. So he was at his best, and he was very, very invested in the stuff.
It sounds like that he was, as you say, like living with these stories and these emotions for a long time. And I guess it's a bit like an actor that sort of bleeds into your real life. And would you say that the performance from him and obviously the emotional state behind it, is that kind of what you think makes the record? Is that what sets it apart from others?
Yeah. Well, you know, we all have our opinions. I think he was talking to Sarah, but he'd deny that. When you talk to Bob about Blood on the Tracks, it's about a series of checkout plays, not him.
Yeah, apparently. That's the party line anyway. Just before we move off Blood on the Tracks, I wanted to talk about the crediting issue. So on the original release of the album, the Minneapolis musicians weren't credited. The New York musicians were credited as playing on the whole album. That was a situation at the time. It's been since rectified. How did you feel about that at the time? Were you upset, or were you just pleased to have been part of it, even if you didn't get an official credit?
I make my own luck, and I had no problem with it. It didn't bother me. You know, I made chicken soup out of it 30 years before I wrote a book, you know, so it was fine. And I went on, and I didn't talk about it for 20 years in Hollywood when I worked on the West Coast, because who's going to believe you?
Yeah.
Your name is not on the jacket, so you just don't bring it up.
Why weren't you included? Was there a particular reason? Was it a record company thing or a decision from someone?
No, it was just a lack of management, lack of decision.
And thankfully, that was obviously corrected in the More Blood, More Tracks bootleg. I guess you were pleased because now you can show people, well, I was on the album. Was that an emotional point for you, or was it just something that you didn't really care too much about?
Well, the credits, my whole career was about credits after that. It became about credits, but not for that reason. Just because songwriters, as digital media came into play, as digital and CDs and now streaming came into play, credits got left by the wayside. So my work was cut out for me by the time I got to Los Angeles and the National Academy of Songwriters. It was obvious that somebody had to advocate, and that was my job.
So the lack of credit on Blood on the Tracks was the reason you joined the National Academy of Songwriters?
No, the reason was because it was an opportunity and I needed a job. It was called Songwriters Resources and Services before that, but it wasn't really doing well until we recruited Bob Dylan, Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil, Liebrand Stoller, other great songwriters. And we created a lobbying effort in Washington, D.C. for source licensing and songwriters' rights and earnings. So we had to kind of reorganize the thing and became de facto lobbyist, I guess you could say.
And I'm guessing that was really rewarding for you.
It was. It was a great, great time.
Listen, Kevin, that was so great to talk to you, and thank you for talking so openly and telling some great stories, and thank you for the Tangled Up in Blue guitar work. I mean, that riff is so incredible, and I think really makes the song. So on behalf of Dylan fans everywhere, thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day. Evening.
Well, have a good day to you. Kevin, thank you so much. That was really good. Continue to have fun on the boat and have a great Christmas as well.
Thank you very much. You too.
Thank you to Kevin for being generous with his time, and thank you to you for listening. We'll do another little special episode of this podcast further down the line, I think, and also a new season will be materializing at some point. Keep your eyes on the podcast feed. Keep your ears on the podcast feed, maybe. Anyway, thank you for listening. I will see you down the road. Take care.